And we're holding on page 8 in Brachos, about the middle, a bit past the middle of the page, Rav Zeira Amar. The Gemara had started discussing the question. We said that David would wake up at Chatzos, so we said that another possibility is he would switch gears at Chatzos. Till then he's learning, and before that he's davening, and after that he's learning or composing Mizmor Tehillim or whatever. So we talked about how did he know exactly when Chatzos is, if even Moshe didn't. Since Moshe says Ka Chatzos Halayla, then we have to assume it means approximately midnight.
After Moshe Rabbeinu, mine says Rabbeinu midday.
Mayday, the line before that. We're going to get to it in a second. Reb Zeira Amar, that's where we're holding.
I'm down too much.
Huh? Yeah, you're about a line ahead of where we are. Reb Zeira Amar is where. Yeah. Okay, so anyway, so we had one answer that in fact David wouldn't have known exactly when it was midnight either, except that he had rigged up the harp above his bed where the north wind would start blowing and strumming on it, and that would wake him up. So now the Gemara gives a different answer. Reb Zeira Amar, Moshe Rabbeinu, Meida have a Yoda, or La'olam have a Yoda. In fact, Moshe perfectly well knew when Chatzos is. There's just two different Gersais. Moshe Rabbeinu, Meida have a Yoda would mean Moshe certainly knew. The other Gersa, the way it's printed in the Gemara is Moshe, La'olam have a Yoda. In fact, Moshe knew when Chatzos is. The David Nami have a Yoda. David also is able to know exactly when Chatzos is. So the kiven did David have a yada kino lomali? Well, the question is then, so why does he need the kino if he knows exactly when midnight is? And the answer is, le'iture mishnase, to wake him up from his sleep. Because we had the different possibilities before of what he was doing before Chatzos and after Chatzos. We had we had Rav Zeira in fact saying that the first half of the night he would doze off here and there, he would take brief naps, and after Chatzos not. So if it happens that one of those naps is before Chatzos, then he needs the kino to wake him up, but not that otherwise he wouldn't know when Chatzos is. So the question is, v'kimin de Moshe have a yada lama lo lamem ka chatzos. So if Moshe knows exactly when chatzos is, then why is he using the word ka chatzos? Why not say ba chatzos? And the answer is Moshe kasabar, because Moshe figured not to say that way. Shema yitu itstagnine paroi, because paroi's stargazers who are in charge of knowing exactly what time it is, they might not know what time it is. V'yemru Moshe badaihu, and they're going to say that Moshe is a liar. So in other words, not that Moshe doesn't know when Chatzos is, but he figures that they're not going to know when Chatzos is. They're going to think Chatzos came and the Makkah hasn't come yet. Or conversely, they're going to think that it came before Chatzos. And they're going to say Moshe doesn't know what he's talking about. Which, by the way, I mean, you're going to, you know, after 9 Makkahs that everything came true and exact in every detail, all of a sudden now the 10th one, one little detail, so it's at 11:59 instead of at 12 o'clock, and all of a sudden they're going to say Moshe Badayu. So on one level, that shows, you know, how much people can rationalize. They're going to grab onto any possibility and even the tiniest little thing to rationalize the fact that all this time they've been opposing the Eivishter. So there is that. But there's also, the Pnei Yeshua also talks about the idea that, after all, they were claiming earlier that Moshe was doing what he accomplishes through Kishuv. Now, Chatzos is specifically, we said before, is an Eis Ratzon, and it's a time when the Mazikim don't have power because the time of Eis Ratzon of Hashem. So if the Makkah happens exactly at Chatzos, they're going to have no choice but to say that Moshe couldn't have accomplished it through magic or through Shadim, but if it happens, if they think it happened even a minute before or after, then they could still rationalize and say that maybe he did it through Shadim or something. So therefore, Moshe has to make sure that they don't think that way. This is like the expression that a Tana says. You find it in Masech Derech Eretz Zuta. Lamed l'shoin chaloyma eni yedeya. Teach your tongue to say, I don't know. Never talk in certainties like this. Even Moshe is saying, kachatzos, shematis bade, because you might be contradicted. V'te'oches, and then you're going to be grabbed. You're going to be, the people are going to grab you, are going to catch you in a lie. So that's another reason why he said kachatzos, but not that he didn't actually know. Rav Ashi, Amar Rav Ashi says a third possibility. But Pauga Uta de Tleso Nagi Abesa have a koi. When Moshe is saying this, when he's saying Kachatzos Halayla Ani Yotze B'Seich Mitzrayim, was on midnight of the 13th of Nisan, going into the 14th. So it was to put it in terms that we would understand. It was B'dikas Chometz night. It was midnight, a couple of hours after that. So Moshe is saying to the Jewish people, Hashem is saying that kachatzos, meaning not approximately chatzos, the kaf is not the approximation kaf, it's rather the kaf, like the word like in English. Again, the word like in English can mean approximately, but it can also mean as now. So as exactly the same time that it is now, in 24 hours, Hashem is saying, I'm the Yotze B'Sef Mitzrayim, I'm going to be going forth through Mitzrayim and striking all the Bechorim. I saw a vote on this also, by the way, that, you know, when you think about it, we're used to the idea that midnight is exactly the same moment in large areas, you know, the entire Eastern time zone, the entire Central time zone or whatever, it's midnight at the same time. Really, of course, we know it's not like that. Clock, the sun time is going to be slightly different from one place to another. So the vote would be that in every place in Mitzrayim, it was like a wave going sweeping through Mitzrayim. In each place, as it exactly hit Chatzos, then the Bechorim in that place died. And then the next town over would be a few seconds later or earlier as Chatzos comes in that place. So that's the kind of thing. According to the previous explanation, the Itztagnine Pare wouldn't necessarily pick up on that kind of thing.
Right. What would be the problem? Let's say Moshe Rabbeinu, they told him Chatzos, and the people didn't figure it out. In other words, it was a minute later.
That's what we said. So just before you walked in, we said two possibilities. Number one is people will always grab onto anything to rationalize their false beliefs, right?
I heard you, but yeah. The fact is, a minute later, they're going to see the Marcus of Bechoros. So it's a minute later, big deal.
Nonetheless, they're still going to use that to grab on as an excuse. Look, Moshe doesn't know what he's talking about. Or according to the Pnei Yeshua, they're going to use that. Look, you see, he's using Shadim rather than that it comes from Hashem. Yeah.
Why did they really care what the Mitzrayim thought?
Because the whole point of the Makos is the V'yodu Mitzrayim Ki Ani Hashem. The whole point of it is that the Mitzrayim should realize once and for all that the Eibishter runs the world. So it's very important for them to be, it's very important for their beliefs to be broken and to be shown that they don't know what they're talking about. So they started realizing it in stages. I mean, you know, look, I mean, you know, some of them realized it enough to actually join the Jewish people. That's what the Erev Rav were. You know, as much as we always talk about how lousy the Erev Rav were and how all the trouble they caused, we got to realize they were the better element among the Mitzrayim, that they actually chose to leave Mitzrayim and join the Jewish people. They were nowhere near the caliber of the born Jews, which is why they're the ones, they couldn't reach the level of bitachon of the born Jews, which is why they're the ones who are always complaining and always starting the problems in the desert. But nonetheless, they were still the better quality Mitzrayim, the worst quality Mitzrayim. So you have within them, you know, you have the Yoreis Dvar Hashem, for example, who paid attention, let's say, during Makas Barar and brought their animals inside, and then you have the ones who didn't. You have your, you know, you have the Chartumim began recognizing by Makas Kinim Etzba Elikimi. So it was a gradual thing. But now, by Makas Bechoros, that was it. You know, everybody has to realize at that point that the Eibishter is running things and there's no possibility for anything else, which is why also V'chol of Kei Mitzrayim Es Shvatim, all the gods of Egypt, had to be broken and destroyed for the same reason.
So all the Mitzrayim that died in the Yam at the last second, it means that at the last second
they realize that the Eibishter is running things. Yeah, I mean, they themselves, you have before, you know, when they see Vayosa as Oifan Makavosa, the Pasuk describes how the wheels of their chariots are falling off and they're getting stuck in the mud and whatever. They say, Ki Hashem Nocham Lahem Mitzrayim. You know what we can see? That Hashem is fighting on behalf of the Jewish people against Mitzrayim and in Mitzrayim too. But by that time, it's too late. Yeah, they should have come to that realization a few days earlier and then they could have been part of the Erev Rav. Yeah.
Too little, too late.
Exactly. Okay. So now, since we're talking about, David's nighttime schedule. So now let's talk about what he does during the daytime. So we said before that we learned yesterday that in the morning the Chachamim would come to visit him. They'd have the cabinet meeting for the day to discuss the agenda. But what's David doing the rest of the day? So we start off with a pasuk that David says, "Well, David." Skipping a few words, Shamra Nafshiki Chassid Ani, guard my soul because I'm a Chassid. We say this every day in davening, well, every day that we say Tachnun before Shir Shoyim. So why is David praising himself as a Chassid? On the face of it, a person shouldn't be boasting that I'm a Chassid. So what does he mean by that? What particular thing that he's doing is he focusing on that he's a Chassid? Now we know in general, David was a Chassid in many ways, but what particular is there that he did that he can call himself for that a Chassid? So Rab Levi and Rab Yitzchak. So Rab Levi and Rab Yitzchak argue what David was referring to. Chad Omer, one of them says, Kach Omer David Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, means David is saying to Hashem, Ribbono Shel Olam, Loi Chosid Ani, am I not a Chosid? You should realize, Shekol Malchim Mizrach HaMayrav Yishenim Ad Gimel Shois, all the other kings in the east and the west sleep until 3 hours into the day, like we learned before, and like we said, and like it says later on in the Perek, which is why Sof Zman Kriya Shema is 3 hours in the day. And me, I'm getting up at midnight to praise you, like we said before. Why is he mentioning, by the way, east and west? Marsha points out, because when you go on the globe, if you go to the extreme north and the extreme south, near the north and south poles, you're not going to find any kingdoms over there. It's too cold for anybody to live there. And to the extent that anybody does live there, then they don't have kings. They have maybe like little chiefs or whatever. So therefore, Mizrach Umayrav represents the civilized world. So Maharsha explains, now the pasuk before that, before he said Shomer Nafshi Kichazed Ani, the pasuk before it, he says, Hate Hashem Oznecha Aneni Ki Oni Ve'Evyan Oni. So he's saying, I'm poor and needy. So meaning, in other words, he's saying like this, poor people, what do? They can't afford to sleep in until 3 hours a day. They got to get up early and then go find some work if they want to have some food. Now, I could be acting like a king. After all, I'm rich. I don't need to get up and work for a living. I could be sleeping in like they do. But instead, I act as though I was a poor person and I have to wake up early. Except in my case, it's not for a job. It's in order to praise me. So that's one. The idach and the other between Rabbi Levi and Rabbi Yitzchak says kach al madav lifnei Hakadosh Baruch Hu Rabbanu Shlalem loy chosid ani. Am I not a chosid? Shekol malchim Mizrach Umayrav yoshvim agudos bechvoidam. All the other kings of east and west of the civilized world, they sit together. They sit with groups of their cabinet ministers or of their followers or whoever in their cover. Vani. Me, I don't care about my own cupboard. Yodai melochloches bedom over shfir over shulya. I get my hands dirty with blood and with a shfir and with a shulya, which both of them we learned about in Nidda not so long ago. A shfir is an embryo that's in the early stages of formation. So in the case of dam, a woman brings a shaila with blood to a rub. Is this in fact blood that makes her tummy Nidda? Or as we said, is it one of the colors or shades or whatever that's not tummy? In the case of a shfir, is this developed enough to be even be considered a baby? And if it is it a boy? Is it a boy or a girl? What's the din as far as you may toma and you may tara? And a shulya is the amniotic sac, which comes out with a baby usually. And the rule is in shulya b'loy vlad. If there's an amniotic sac, it means there was a baby. Even if you don't find a baby, as we talk about nida, it means that the baby disintegrated in the womb or something. So then also, so people would be bringing that to David to find out. This particular thing, so now something came out of her, does it in fact meet the criteria that halacha says, the minimum size of a shulya? So Rashi refers to a gemara there in Nida that describes it has a certain minimum size and it has a certain characteristic shape and so forth. So you'd have like a mass that she expels, that she miscarries, and you need to know, is this a shulya or is this stam, a tumor or something? So a shafir is an embryo in the early stages of development. The word shafir is related to the word shreferis, because when a baby is first formed, when the early stages of formation, it's like a hollow tube, and then inside it, the various internal organs start forming, and eventually the limbs and whatever start forming as protrusions from it. So therefore, a shafir, or shfir, whatever, is an embryo in the very early stages of development. And so you need, if a woman miscarries, such a thing, you have a shayla. Is she tummy from a birth or not? And if it's a birth, would it have been a boy or a girl? So David is saying, I personally, I don't just delegate that to somebody else. I don't say it's beneath my dignity as king to deal with that. I personally get my hands dirty with such kinds of things. In order to make a woman tahor for her husband, if I can find a way that it won't be matame her, then I'm working on doing that. So it's not necessarily before 40 days. It's at some early point of the development of the embryo. Then it's called a shofar. Yeah. So shlil is actually made from the skin of an unborn animal. It's similar to the word shulya. It's not identical. I mean, the shulya itself is the amniotic sac that the baby forms inside. But yeah, it's related. The shlil is an unborn baby. Because practically speaking, but it's thinner. But I think there's also the idea, because like it hasn't even been in the world yet. It hasn't, like, so to speak, been exposed to the tumma of the world yet. So yeah. So the shulya in modern Hebrew, shulya means a placenta. In Gemara terminology, it means the amniotic sac. Now the placenta is kind of attached to that, so maybe the shulya in the Gemara includes the placenta as well. But primarily, it means the sac that the fluids and the baby are inside. Yeah. Anyway, so Maharsha explains again the same kind of idea. Ki chosid va'oni oni, ki oni ve'evyan oni. Same idea. A poor person has to set aside any dignity that he has and work even with dirty things because he has to earn a living. Me, I'm working with dirty things not because I have to earn the living, but because I want to. Because I'm paskening halachas in Torah for your covered Hashem. Now, Bechlal, we have to ask, why is David, so okay, these are very nice things that David is doing, but why is it so important for him to stress to Hashem that he's a chassid? So HaKosev over here brings a long explanation. He says this Kapitel Tilim, Kapitel Pei Vav, he says, was written after the story of Bathsheba. And he says an interesting point. If you look at the order of Sefer Tilim, the first two Sfarim of Tilim are mostly compositions by David himself. Many of them actually have in the caption, LeDavid. Then you come to the third Sefer of Tilim, beginning Kapitel Ayin Gimel. And for the most part, that whole Sefer of Tilim is mostly compositions by Osaf or by Bnei Korach. Mizmor la'asaf achtov liYisrael la'matzeach al tashkis la'asaf and so forth, livnei Korach and so forth. Then in the middle, stuck in over there, Kapitel Pei Vav is a kapitel by David. All of a sudden, the David elach Hashem, not elach Hashem. Whatever the David tefillah David hatei Hashem oznachanin. So what is that doing in the middle? What is that doing in the middle over there? So he says, because Kapitel Pei Hei talks about Tshuva, and so they're talking about when the Jewish people are in Golus and they do Tshuva and Hashem brings the Gola. So therefore, when Tilim was put, when David put Tilim in the order that we have it, he put in right after that a Kapitel where he himself is asking Hashem to forgive him after the story of Bathsheba, after he did Tshuva. So now he's saying, being that I'm a chassid, please judge me lefnim meshur asadin. Even though I deserve quite a bit of punishment, and the fact he did undergo quite a bit of punishment for it, but at least please have rachmanos on me that it shouldn't be a permanent thing. The last pasuk he says, "I say me ois l'toiva," for example, as the Gemara mentions elsewhere, that he's asking, "Show me a sign, even while I'm alive, that you've forgiven me for the avera." So that's why he's stressing ki chosid ani, because he's using that as a basis to ask Hashem to please forgive him. Then there's another explanation as well. Pnei Yeshua gives a very interesting explanation. When the Jewish people first asked for a king, so who was the first king? Shaul. And we know the whole story over there, how at first not everybody accepted him as king, but then there was a battle against Nachash Melech Bnei Ammon, and then everybody is willing to accept him as king. So Shmuel gathers all the people together and gives them a long speech, and most of it is after the Parshas Korach. Anyway, at the end, Shmuel finishes off his speech and says, if you do good, then wonderful. You'll be in good shape and your king will be in good shape. The im horeya toreu, he says, but if you do badly, gam atem, gam malkachem tisofu, both you and your king are going to be destroyed. So now David is concerned about that. After all, he needs to make sure that he's definitely in the best possible shape in Hashem's eyes in order that shouldn't happen. Therefore, he's asking Hashem, please realize that I'm a chassid. I'm going to fnim meshur asadin with these kinds of things. And therefore, don't let that threat that Shmuel said decide that should have to come true. How do they know this? So that's the thing. So we have to, they're analyzing the psukim. So that's the thing. For example, Marashah is saying, they're analyzing, since David is saying, ki chosid va'oni oni, so we have to understand that there's something about what David is doing, some special chosidus that usually you would find only an oni would do. Yeah, right. And David continues. So not only am I involved with this blood and shvir and shilya, all these things that most people would consider repulsive, but I'm doing them kedei l'tayr ish l'bayla v'loy oid. Not only that, David continues. Elisha kol ma she'ani oseh ani nimlach b'fi boishes ram. Everything that I do, whenever I'm deciding a question in halacha, I always consult with my rebbe b'fi boishes. And I ask him b'fi boishes. Mifiboshes Rebbe, Yofed Damti, did I judge correctly? Yofed Chiyavti, Yofed Zikisi, did I decide who's guilty and who's innocent correctly, which is by Dinin Afoshes and Dinin Mominus, Rashi says. Yofeti Hauti, Yofeti Mesi, did I correctly declare this Tahar or Tomei? Veloy Boshti, and I was not embarrassed to ask him. So, now, who is Mifiboshes? So let's talk. So let's talk about like this. The name Mephibosheth and various names that have Boshes in them ran in Shaul's family. So you have as follows. Shaul himself had three sons who were killed with him in his last battle at Har HaGeboya. Then he had a fourth son named Ishbosheth, who afterwards was a rival king to David for 2.5 years. That Ishbosheth is also called in a different pasuk Eshbaal. Then you have David, then you had Shaul, in addition, had some sons with a Pelegesh by the name of Ritzvah Basaya. One of those sons was named Mephibosheth. Later on, you have at the end of Sefer Shmuel, you have the story with the Givonim, where they were angry at Shaul and they had to be appeased. And David ended up having to give them seven of Shaul's children or grandchildren and allow them to execute them. So that's one possibility is the Mephibosheth we're talking about over here is that one, is Shaul's son. The other possibility is that we also have now Yonasan, David's friend, had a son named Mephibosheth, and later on you find in Sefer Shmuel where David is asking, he wants to find the descendant of Yonasan and do good with him, and he ends up inviting him to the palace, and he's going to be a constant guest at his table, and his name was also Mephibosheth. So which Mephibosheth we're talking about over here, different Mephibosheth disagree. On the one hand, the one who was the son of Yonasan, on the face of it, like you said, it's going to be a while before David even gets a hold of him, and he's much younger than David. How is he David's Rebbe? On the other hand, the one who was Shaul's son from his Pilegish, for one thing, he ended up being killed by the Givonim. Now, fine, that was towards the end of David's reign, but you have to ask them in that case, why didn't David try to protect him? We find that it says that Mephibosheth, the son of Yonasan, David davened for him that he shouldn't end up being one of the seven that are picked. If the Mephibosheth, who was the son of Shaul, was his Rebbe, on the face of it, he should have done the same thing. So you have a good deal of discussion. And you have also, it also depends on different gersois that we're going to say over here in the Gemara in a second, of that he had another name. So yeah.
I didn't ask that. It said before that he asked the Mephibosheth every time on any halacha that he did.
Yeah.
Is this okay?
Right.
But Mephibosheth didn't check the blood with him. And didn't.
Says who? Maybe Mephibosheth was there at the time. Or David is reporting to him afterwards, you know, somebody brought me this and this. Like he describes it to him. Did I judge it correctly? But again, we're not just talking about as far as Shvir and Shulia and whatever. David is saying everything that I judge. When I judge the case in Dinim Momenus, I would consult with Mephibosheth and ask him whether I did right. If he asks before, then fine. Maybe Mephibosheth wasn't always available to ask before. But he's saying, even after the fact, I would ask. And if it turns out that I was wrong, he says, Veloy Boshti, I wasn't embarrassed. Even if Mephibosheth points out to me afterwards, you know what, you didn't know what you were talking about. Which, by the way, there's an interesting point over here. Rashi uses the expression, that sometimes he would make a mistake and he would tell him, you made a mistake. Now, who's the he made a mistake? On the face of it, it means sometimes David would make a mistake and Mephibosheth would correct him and say, you know what, you made a mistake. On the other hand, Eitz Yosef here brings a very interesting point from the Smichus Chacham. He says, we have a Gemara elsewhere that says that David had the special quality of Hashem Imo Shalocha Kemoise B'chomokim, that David had special Tziyata Dishmaya, which Shaul did not, to always come to the right answer in Halacha. So how is it then that he would be making a mistake and Mephibosheth would be correcting him? So rather, says the Smichas Chachamim, what it means is when Rashi says Hoyatoya, Mishapam Hoyatoya, means sometimes Mephibosheth would be mistaken. He would be correcting David, where it turns out that his correction itself is mistaken. Nevertheless, David says, I still accepted the correction and I would be machmir if I knew that Mephibosheth holds differently. Then to be on the safe side, I would be machmir if I know that he holds differently, even though it might be that he's not correct after all.
Why is he accepting? Was he so bitter? I don't know.
Because he had bitter. That's what we're saying. Yes. Yeah. So I'm going to be sure, Breder of Idi, Micro, where's a posik that we see that David acted that way? You have another posik in Kapitel Kofiyot Tes, Va'adabra be'edei secha, David says, I speak about your testimonies, about the Torah, Negen Malachim, in front of kings, V'loi Evosh, and I'm not embarrassed. Now, kings can mean, first of all, Tamar Chachamim, Man Malfi Rabbanon. Second of all, it can mean specifically, so Mephibosheth was a Tamar Chacham, so therefore, yeah. Or the other possibility is it can mean Malachim, because Mephibosheth was actually from a royal family. His father or grandfather was Shaul, after all. So therefore, he can be described as Negin Malachim. The Tana, we learn in a Braisa, Loi Mephibosheth Shmoi, his real name was not Mephibosheth, Ela Ishbosheth Shmoi. His real name was Ishbosheth. Now here you have a problem, the Ishbosheth that we know of in the Psukim, who was a son of Shaul, who was a rival king for 2.5 years during David's reign, but he was killed very early in David's reign. Eventually the Pasuk describes how at one point two of his officers sneaked into the house while he was napping and they assassinated him. So how is he available for years after that, throughout David's reign, for David to be learning from him? So there are Rishonim who have the Girsa over here, and Marsha brings it over here, that the mefiboshes we're talking about over here is not ish boshes. The Gemara should not be saying ish boshes shmoi. Rather, it should be saying meriv baal shmoi. The one mefiboshes, the son of Yonason, who David invited to the palace and made him a guest at his table and so forth. In Divrei Hayomim, it names him instead. In Divrei Hayomim, when it tells about the descendants of Shaul, it instead calls him meriv baal. So therefore, maybe the correct here, so over here, should be Ella Meriv Baal Shmo, that his real name is Meriv Baal, and then the Gemara is going to explain why his nickname is Mephibosheth. Another possibility that Rishonim bring is maybe the correct Girsa is supposed to be Ella Esh Baal Shmoi. And you find that it mentions in Divrei Hayomim also, it mentions a son of Shaul named Esh Baal, and that could be the same as the Mephibosheth who later on was killed by the Gibbon. So you have different possibilities which Mephibosheth it is. Anyway, so Veloma Nikra Shmoi Mephibosheth, so why is he called that? Show you Mevayish Pnei David Bahalofa. The word Mephibosheth is short for Mevayish Pnei. He would humiliate David's face in Halacha. In other words, because David would have decided something in Halacha or think to be deciding something in Halacha, and Mephibosheth would tell him, you're wrong. So David was embarrassed by that, realizing that he had forgotten some key point or whatever. So Lefichach, so because of that, because David was willing to accept such humiliation and allow that he's going to listen to what Mephibosheth says, Zocha David b'yotzim men of Kilov. David himself ended up having the schus that he had a son named Kilov. And what's so special about Kilov? So V'omer, I have Reish Yud in front of me. I don't know what it expands to. Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yonason. Okay. Thank you. Loi Kilov Shmoi. His real name was not Kilov. Ella Daniel Shmoi. His real name was Daniel. And we know that because there are a few places in Tanakh where it lists the first few sons of David. So there's one place in Sefer Shmuel where it lists them. It says the oldest was Amnon and the second one was Kilov. Then in Divrei Hayomim, it gives the same list, but instead of the second one being named Kilov, instead the second one is named Daniel. So we understand that his real name was Daniel. V'lomenik v'shmei Kilov. So why is he nicknamed Kilov? Because he in turn would embarrass Mephibosheth's face in Halacha. In other words, he would be able to defend David's position and show that after all, David was right and Mephibosheth was wrong. So therefore he's called Kilov, Meloshin Machlim, and Ov. Because the word Ov can mean, that. So Rashi explains that it means that the Rav, Mephibosheth, is like an Ob, he's like a father, and he's Machlim, he's embarrassing him by showing that after all, David's position was right, and Mephibosheth's is not. Marsha says that actually it could be that why does he end up having the ability to humiliate Mephibosheth in discussions, because Mephibosheth in turn had previously humiliated his father. So we're not talking revenge, of course, but we're talking about, in other words, that Kilov was an outstanding Talmid Chacham who had the ability to defend David's position and show how, after all, David was right in matters of Halacha. So his nickname because of that was Kilov. By the way, the Gemara tells us in Bava Basra, this Kilov is one of only four people in history where the only reason he passed away is because of the chetei tadas, the etia shel nafash. But other than that, he had no averus of his own. So David had the schus to have a son of such a caliber because earlier when Mephibosheth was discussing things with him, he was willing to bow to Mephibosheth's knowledge, even though, again, as we said from the Eitz Yosef, from the Smichas HaChamim, maybe in fact David after all was right because he had Siat Shmaya, but because on the face of it, Mephibosheth's proofs were stronger, therefore David would go along with it to be machmir, to be on the safe side, and therefore he had the schus to have such an outstanding son. So Kilov stands for Machlim Ov. Machlim means he embarrasses. Ov means the father. So Rashi says the father means Mephibosheth because a Rebbe is like a person's ruchniistic father. And Marsha says it means he embarrasses in order to defend his own father, David. Yeah. V'olav Omer Shloimeh v'chochmasei. Shloimeh referred to somebody like Kilov in his Chochma in Sefer Mishlei, where he has Psukim. He says, Bni im Chocham libecha. He says, my son, so he's writing over there as if like in David's voice, and speaking to Kilov, my son, im Chocham libecha, if your heart has become wise, yismach libi gam oni, my heart will also be happy. In other words, I can be happy over the fact that you've managed to win out over Mephibosheth. I am happy because to begin with, I thought that he had the right opinion in Halacha, and it turns out that you showed how, after all, I had the right one. And another pasuk in Mishlei says, Chacham bni v'samach libi, my son is wise, my heart is happy. And I am able to respond with words back to those who would mock me. Meaning, in other words, Maharsha says that because of you, because Kilav, because you're by my side and you're able to bring solid proofs for what I said, therefore, when we have Mephibosheth, my Rebbe, who was humiliating me and was mocking me and saying that I don't know what I'm talking about in halacha, I'm able to respond to him and show him that after all, my opinions are very solidly based in Torah. So the Gemara continues. The David in worth mentioning in this connection about this Mephibosheth, if it's Mephibosheth ben Yohanan, you have an interesting thing in the Psukim over there. So you have, how does David first find Mephibosheth? So the Psukim describe there in Shmuel Bey's Perek Tes that David is asking, is there anybody left from Yohanan's descendants? I had a covenant of friendship with him. I want to continue that with his descendants. There's a man named Siva, who's a slave of Shaul's family. So he reports to David that yes, there is a son of Yonasan named Mephibosheth, Bil Loy Devor. Now, on the face of it, Loy Devor is the name of a city in Avar Yavin. So he's telling him that's where he's located. And then the pasuk says that David calls him from Mephibosheth and brings him Mi Loy Devor. So again, on the face of it, it means Tziva tells him this is where he's living, and David brings him from there. But there's a medrash actually that explains that the word Loy Devor also means no word. So it means Tziva is saying Lashon Hara about Mephibosheth. He's claiming Mephibosheth has Loy Dover. He has no words. He's an Amaretz. So what do you need him for? David brings him and he finds that's wrong. Mi Loy Dover. He finds from being thought that he's Loy Dover. It turns out, in fact, that he's a tremendous Talmid Chacham. Yeah. Okay. So the Gemara says, "V'David hechi kodel nafshe chassid." Now, how can David be calling himself a chassid in the first place? Fine, we said before the various reasons why he's doing that, but still, shouldn't he be? Don't we see a different pasuk where David is concerned that maybe he doesn't have schosim in Hashem's eyes at all? V'haksiv lulei hemanti ludas betuv Hashem be'eretz chayim in l'David Hashemori. We're saying it now twice a day. So David says, were it not, lule means if it weren't for the fact, hemanti ludas betuv Hashem, that I trusted that I would see the goodness of Hashem, be'eretz chayim, in the land of the living, where the land of the living primarily means Gan Eden, and the tonim shmeidet Rabbi Yosi, lomon nokud al lule. Why are there dots on the word lule? If you look in a printed tilim or in a ksav yad of tilim, you'll find, you know, we know there's a number of places in Tanakh where you have dots on words. Here you have the letters of the word lule have dots. Actually, it's very interesting. If you look in Minchas Shaya on the pasuk, and if you look in Tanakhs that are printed accurately, there the word lule has dots not only on top but also on bottom. It's unique. There's no other word in all of Tanakh that has dots on the bottom. I'll be a masoda. So the word lule literally means were it not, but it can also mean yeah. It can also mean it's like an expression of uncertainty. Yeah. So why are there dots on it? And in general, when we have dots, it means that it means like we're taking away some part of what it says over there. So it means, in other words, it's not a certain thing. So Omer David lifnei Hakadosh Baruch Hu, Ribono Shel Olam, muvtachani b'cha she'atem meshalem socher tov latzadikim lo'asav lavoy. I am certain, I do believe, hemanti, that you are going to give a good reward to the tzadikim lo'asav lavoy. Aval eini yadei im yesh li chelek b'neihem min lav. But I don't know whether I have a part among them or not. So that's why the lulei has dots on it. Now, so Maharsha talks about in some detail over here. The usual rule is that on the contrary, lule is really more of an expression of were it not. In other words, if it had been not, then not. But I'm certain that it is. You're saying if it weren't this way, but it is this way. So therefore, so if you have the dots over there, wouldn't that mean that on the contrary you're saying that it's something clear? So Maharsha explains that we're not doushening all of the dots on the word lule. What we're doushening primarily is the dots on the letters lamed aleph. They have four letters. They are Lamed, Vav, Lamed, Aleph. We're primarily dashing the dots on the Lamed and the Aleph. So therefore, that allows us to read it as if it said, Loi he'emanti. I did not believe Lidus B'tuv Hashem. I did not trust that Lidus B'tuv Hashem, that I'm going to get to see the goodness of Hashem. Be'eretz HaChaim. In other words, I'm not certain whether I'm going to or not. So what is this? So how could David be calling himself a chosid then?
The definition of chosid
means somebody who acts lefnim meshuras hadin. And in fact, we learned in Nida not so long ago, we had the whole thing about the fingernails, where a chosid burns his fingernails rather than burying him, where we said a chosid is willing to accept a harm to himself rather than even the possibility of a harm to somebody else. So similar, we said before, for example, that David is dirtying his hands personally with the shvir and the shulia, whatever, in order to help out women to be make them tahor for their husbands. So yeah.
The Rebbe says, what's the pasid? He talks on it a little bit, thinks more than that, and does the most in action.
Okay. So the question is not, we know that David was a chassid, but how is he calling himself a chassid in the pasuk when in another pasuk he's saying, I'm not even certain that I deserve a place in Gan Eden? And the answer is, Savar means that David figured, Shema Yigrim Achet. He figures that after all, I might have done Averis. I am a chassid, fine, but after all, what happens? I might eventually do an Avera, and that Avera would prevent me, Liris B'Tshuva Hashem Be'eretz Chaim. And that would be like what Rabbi Yaakov Ba'idi says. Did Rabbi Yaakov Ba'idi Rami? He pointed out a contradiction between Psukim when it comes to Yaakov. Hashem promises Yaakov, I'll be with you and I'll guard you wherever you go. But later on, when he's about to meet Esav, then Yaakov is very afraid. What's he afraid of if Hashem promised to protect him? So the same thing, means the same thing. Yaakov was also thinking, what if I've done an Avera, or what if in the future I might do an Avera, and therefore I might forfeit Hashem's protection. Now, Marsha has a long discussion about the point over here. First of all, Marsha says, don't we have the very next part, a couple of psukim later, where Yaakov himself says, katonti mikola chasadim, that I've used up all my schusim. So why is he, so what kind of Shema Yigrim Achet? Maybe he's afraid that maybe he used up all his chusim on the various nisim that happened to him so far. So Marsha says, no, if that were the case, that still wouldn't be a reason for Hashem to revoke his promise to him. That might mean maybe he's not worthy of nisim in the future because he's used up all his chus. But to have ad kedei kach that Hashem would allow him to be destroyed by Esav when Hashem promised to guard him, that wouldn't happen. And then that brings Marsha into a long discussion over here, Bechlal. We have a concept that it says whenever Hashem promised something for good, then he never revokes it. When Hashem promises to a Navi something not good that's going to happen, then the people can do tshuva, or Hashem can be patient or whatever, like you have with Nineveh or whatever, and it can be revoked. But a good promise for good, there's only one time, there's Gemara in Shabbos, that says that there was something that Hashem told the Navi that he's going to spare the tzaddikim of Yerushalayim, and then he ended up deciding that they should be marked for death as well. But that's the only exception.
We just had a Rashi recently about that, the same.
We had an Parashat Shoftim over there by the Nevi'im, yeah.
That includes that Hashem's promise to Mashiach, he has to deliver the God.
That is true. But anyway, so getting back to, that's true. Anyway, so the point is, so what do you mean Shema Yigrim Achet? If Hashem promised Yaakov that he's going to protect him, how does Yaakov have any thought that might not happen? So Marsha discusses over here some details about it. The Rambam explains that there's a difference between a nevuah that Hashem says to a Navi to deliver to the Jewish people versus one that he says to the Navi person. The message that Hashem told Yaakov, Shmartich b'chol shatelech, was not a message for anybody else's ears. It was given to Yaakov personally. So therefore, it might be Shema Yigrim Achet. When Hashem tells a promise explicit to a Navi explicitly, and it's meant to deliver to the Jewish people, then Hashem's not going to revoke it. And then Marsha goes into some detail over here that what we can mean is that if it's just they lost their schusim, then just chet alone wouldn't be a reason for Hashem to revoke a promise for good. But if there's chet plus the fact that they used up all their schusim, then maybe yes, which is in fact what happened in Yechezkel's times. Okay, so Kedetanya, where do we see this idea that chet can cause a promise of Hashem to be revoked? Kedetanya, we learn in a Braisa, we say in Oz Yosher, Ad Yaver Amcha Hashem, Ad Yaver Am Zukanisa, until your people pass over Hashem, until the people that you took for yourself Passover. So why the double expression? Ad Yaver Amcha Hashem Zubir Rishoyna. That refers to the first time that they crossed the Yarden and come into Israel. Ad Yaver Am Zukanisa Zubir Shnia. That refers to the time when they cross over to come to Eretz Israel the second time around in Ezra's times. So since the pasuk is putting them together, Mikan Omru Chachamim. Based on this, the Chachamim are saying, Ru'uyim Hoyi Yisrael Le'osas Lam Nes B'me Ezra K'derech Shanas Lam Me Yeshua Ben Nun. The Jewish people should have been worthy that Nisim would be done for them in the times of Ezra, like were done in the time of Yeshua Ben Nun, which means, Rashi says, in the times of Yeshua Ben Nun, no nation, no Goyish nation had to give them permission to enter Eretz Yisrael. They entered Biyad Chazaka. It should have been that way in Ezra's times as well. Instead, it wasn't. They needed permission from Kodesh, and afterwards they were subjugated to the various Persian kings after that. Why is that? Elisha Gorem Achet, because the Chatoyim that they had done prevented that from happening. Rashi says it means the Chatoyim during the first space of Mikdash. Not Rashi over here. Rashi elsewhere says that the chet was that the chatoyim during the first space of Mikdash. There are other mafarshim who explain that it means even at the beginning of the second space of Mikdash. We know from the Pesukim in Ezra there was intermarriage. There were other problems over there. So therefore, the point is that we see that because of chet, then the implied promise over there in Ad Yavram Sukhanisa did not in fact come to pass. Nevertheless, like you were saying, ultimately a promise of Hashem has to come true, and it will come true. Loss of love. So the same thing, the promise of Mashiach, it's been deferred, but it will happen, and it will happen, Hashem, when Hashem promises something, it's definitely going to happen.
This beer that talk about crossing over, it's the same beer as the Kashmir to the moon, yeah? Same word?
Well, it's the same word, it means coming in, yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach Ugo'ola, Yom Tesevel. So the Rebbe talked about that. How do we go out of Golus and how do we come into Yemos Mashiach? So Chazal told us the expression from the Zoya that since the Jewish people are going to be able to taste from the tree of life, which is the Sefer HaZoya, with that, the Yipun Vemin Golus Rachni, with that, they will leave Golus through Rachni. As Mashiach answered the Baal Shem Tov, that Chia Futsa minus Secha Chutza, then Mashiach will come. Miyad Mamash. Continuing on halachas of mezuman, if you have seven people who ate bread and three people who ate other things, fruit or drinks or whatever, where they need to make a bracha achrona, then they can say the mezuman with Hashem's name. There now, unlike before, we were talking about if you want to join a third person to your mezuman, and we talked about the various poskim that discuss that they have to have eaten bread. Is it enough if they ate mezonos? Is it enough if they ate fruit? Here, everybody agrees that peiros or a drink is enough. And it's a mitzvah to try and find 10 to bench b'shem. But if you only have 6-8 bread, then you can't do b'zimun b'shem because you need a ruba de minker, you need a noticeable roy.